that you don't get with these other sorts of mathematical explanations. So there's, I have a slightly different take on what I originally said to Doreen, but I think the sort of the line is a consistent one. So I want to start just by talking a little bit about the idea of using mathematics in physical explanations, sort of kind of set the stage of the background debates about that. I'm not going to go into those, but just as a way of contrasting what I think has been the discussion in the philosophy of mathematics literature from the sorts of things that I want to talk about. Then I want to give a brief sort of summary of the renormalization group and how it's used, and say a little bit about the different ways it's used in QFT versus statistical physics or condensed matter theory. Then talk about how you get out some physical ideas and notions from the renormalization group, and finally talk about the nature of explanation and what's actually explained in the context of using the renormalization group. Okay, so a lot of the discussion in the philosophy of mathematics and indeed in philosophy of science on the applicability of mathematics to physics in general goes back to Wigner's problem about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in physics. And the question arises about what effectiveness means here, and there are a number of different things that you can mention with respect to effectiveness. You can talk about the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for formulating laws, and here you have issues about symmetries, idealizations, and a number of different people have written on this, Stephen French, Bob Bowderman, and several others. Then you can talk also about the explanation of physical phenomena via mathematical entities. And here, Alan Baker, Mark Colyvan, Chris Pincock, all of them have written about those kinds of issues and what the status of mathematics is given its importance in certain types of physical explanations. And then finally, there's also the ability to predict physical effects from what look like simply mathematical frameworks. And so an example of that would be the Eightfold Way. And Soren Bangu is one of the people who's written on that. So all of those issues focus on the applicability of mathematics, whether it's eliminable, and if not, what are we actually committed to when we accept the role of mathematics in physical explanations. So usually the focus there, from the point of view of the philosophy of mathematics literature, is focusing on the status of the entities, the mathematical entities in those debates. And the discussion centers around the importance of strategies like inference to the best explanation in arguing for some kind of ontological account of mathematical entities. So if you can't give a physical explanation without the mathematical entities, they figure necessarily, or they're a necessary component of the physical explanation, then that gives you a good reason to be a mathematical realist, say. So the question then that arises in this context is, well, what constitutes the difference between a sort of mathematical explanation, a purely mathematical explanation, versus a physical explanation that makes use of mathematics? Because there's a difference here, I think. Now, one of the case studies in the literature that's often discussed is one that Alan Baker has talked about the life cycle of cicadas in North America. And the case study points out that there are a number of different evolutionary explanations. I'm not going to go into all of the details here, but there are a number of evolutionary explanations, but they all require appeal to mathematical facts about prime numbers and the notion of a lowest common multiple. So the question then is, are we somehow committed to the existence of prime numbers, given that they figure importantly in the explanation. Well, and several people who argue for realism about mathematics in these kinds of contexts claim that this is a purely mathematical explanation. Well, I think that it is a mathematical explanation of sorts, but there are also physical components here because there are evolutionary accounts that are also feature crucially in the explanation. So we've got a kind of mixed bag here about what it being both mathematical and physical. But the question then, I want to just sort of change direction a little bit. Because there are a lot of cases where you do have mathematics alone that seems to generate new physics or new physical sorts of explanations, not just simply predictions, like cases like the Eightfold Way. And there are two examples come from physics, namely gauge theory and gauge fields, and also the use of the thermodynamic limit and renormalization group in explaining critical behavior. So what I want to sort of focus on is say, look, I think as philosophers of physics or as philosophers of science, what is kind of even more interesting from our point of view is how the physics and mathematics become intertwined. It's not so much a question, I think, about the realism about the status of mathematical entities, but rather looking at how the physics and the mathematics become intertwined, and how we should understand the status of physical entities and physical explanations that seem to emerge from mathematical structures like gauge theory or like the renormalization group. So what this represents then, I think, from the point of view of philosophy of science or philosophy of physics, is a sort of inversion of the typical problem, because now we want to look at the status of the physical components that are in the explanation that come from the mathematics. Now, there's an obvious response from, you know, the mathematical realists or from varieties of structural realism, which says that, well, look, we don't need to worry about this kind of connection or this kind of interaction, because external reality just really is a mathematical structure. And physics is a kind of epiphenomena. So you can think of an elementary particle as simply a unitary irreducible representation of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group. And you can think about properties of particles like spin purely in group theoretical terms. So we can really be reductionists here and talk about nature simply in terms of mathematical structures. And that's certainly what the kind of view that some of the structural realists want to put forward. And some varieties of Platonism as well would argue that sort of thing. But, you mean, that presents an obvious problem from the point of view of just, you know, real life. Doesn't fit very well with the nature of physics as we know it or the nature of physics as we practice it. And it's not clear also that that kind of reductionism actually answers any problems if you want to understand the nature of physics. So if you want to understand physical dynamics, pure, straightforward reduction to mathematics doesn't actually tell you very much. So I think there are some more interesting questions that philosophers of physics or philosophers of science can actually look at here. And some of those questions, or two of those questions, is how does mathematics generate physical explanations? And one that I alluded to before, what are the differences between mathematical explanation, physical explanations that require mathematics and mathematical techniques or frameworks that produce physical answers? So I'm going to talk a little bit about the second one, but I'm going to talk also in a very pointed way about the first one in the discussion of the renormalization group. Okay, so I said before that there were a couple of different contexts where mathematics produces physics or physical explanations. One is group theory, gauge theory, where we talk about mathematical entities like symmetries. And the other is renormalization group, where you have a kind of mathematical method. So it's not so much that you're talking about a particular kind of entity, but you're talking about how you use a particular method to generate some kind of physical answer or physical content. So in the first case, so we have a quote here from Steven Weinberg that says, there are symmetry principles that dictate the very existence of all the known forces of nature. So the idea here is that you can generate a physical dynamics simply from symmetry principles or group theory alone. Now, there are lots of problematic issues that arise in these kinds of contexts. And Richard Healy has a very nice book that describes a lot of these issues. It's called Gauging What's Real. But some of them just relate to, first of all, the physical status of gauge invariants. Should we interpret it realistically? If it isn't, then the accompanying forces or interactions seem to be fictitious. Secondly, is what's the status of the gauge field? Is the gauge field a real field? Isn't the gauge field largely put in by hand? Are there other considerations that are required to get out the physics? So the question is, really, do we generate a physical dynamic simply from the sort of mathematics of gauge theory and group theory? And it's not entirely straightforward, but people take different sides on this. Now, the renormalization group, I think, is a slightly different kind of situation. And the sort of common view is that renormalization group allows us to understand certain aspects of critical phenomena and also, to some extent, quantum field theory that actually we weren't able to understand prior to that. And that's certainly true. But I think the question is, how does it enable us to understand those issues? And how is it that we get some kind of physical explanatory dynamics out of that? So the problematic issues here, of course, are the role of the thermodynamic limit. If we're generating physical explanations that require us to postulate infinite systems, then in what case is that a real physical explanation? And people have written on that, certainly Bob Batterman is the person who's written most on that in his book, Devil in the Details, and also several other papers. But John Ehrman and Craig Callender have been very critical of the role of the thermodynamic limit in generating physical explanations, and Gordon Bellett as well. So mostly people are kind of on the opposing side of that, or the side opposite to the one Bob is trying to argue for. And the second question is, well, isn't the renormalization group simply a calculational method? So, you know, doesn't it allow us to get, you know, the right sorts of quantitative answers, but, you know, it doesn't really give us any kind of physical understanding. So I want to argue that we can certainly make sense of the role of one in a very substantive way, and it's actually more than a calculational method. So we'll take, first of all, some of the claims that Bob Batterman has made, because he's also somebody who argues very much in favor of the necessity of the thermodynamic limit. He says the thermodynamic limit is an explanatorily essential mathematical operation. There's a genuine mathematical explanation of a physical phenomena here. There's no appeal to existence of mathematical entities or properties. We appeal to a mathematical idealization resulting from a limit operation, and these explain without representing the system in question. So the idea then is that we have this, the thermodynamic limit represents a limiting operation that provides us with an explanation of certain kinds of phenomena, but it doesn't represent anything physical. And it doesn't involve mathematical entities in the way that numbers do. Now, I agree that it provides us with explanations, but I have a number of points of disagreement, I guess, where I part company with Bob. And one is that the mathematical idealization, I think, is a mathematical description. The notion of an infinite system is a mathematical description, and as such, it involves mathematical properties. So I do think that there's a descriptive element here, and I do think that it involves more than just the notion of taking a limit. There's a representation involved here. And the kind of the idealization itself, the thermodynamic limit, I think plays an explanatory role because it provides us with a representation of the system that we're interested in looking at. So I think that it's important, at least for my purposes, to say that this is more than just an issue of taking limits. I think there's more built into this idea, and it's by acknowledging what is built into that idealization that allows us, I think, in the end, to get out the explanatory content. So the remainder of the talk is going to focus on that. So what I want to do then is clarify how the thermodynamic limit actually figures in physical explanations, why it's necessary in the case of phase transitions. So, and as such, the mathematics then, in its application, becomes very intimately bound up with the physics. So we get not just a mathematical explanation, but we get this kind of integrated explanation where we have the physics and the mathematics bound together. It arises out of a mathematical framework, but in the actual explanation, we get this kind of integration of the two. So what is the renormalization group then? And of course, most of the people here are going to, this is sort of, you know, very simple explanation of what it is, but I just want to go through this to kind of focus the point. So really, we can define it in terms of a mathematical framework used to investigate changes in the physical system viewed at different distance scales. So in particle physics, it will reflect changes in the underlying force law as you vary the energy scale. And so the main notion here is one of scale invariance. And a scale invariance symmetry is just a situation where the system is going to appear the same at all scales. So there's a notion of self-similarity. In general, then, the system will make a self-similar copy of itself with slightly different parameters describing the components of the system and the interactions between them. So the notion of scale invariance then is bound up with this idea of the system making a kind of self-similar copy. So, for example, coupling constants that measure the strength of various forces. The electron has different charge at short distances than at large distances. So that change in the charge of the electron, what's called the running coupling, the value of the charge is determined by the renormalization group equations as you go from scale to scale, as you employ the scaling equation. So it's important, I think, here to distinguish at this point, for those of people who aren't so familiar with this, between the old-fashioned notion of renormalization that was associated with quantum electrodynamics to get rid of ultraviolet divergences, and the notion of renormalization group transformations. Old-fashioned renormalization involved a theory of mass and charge where the infinity was cut off by an implicit ultra-large mass scale. Now, so the dependence there on the physical quantities the mass scale was hidden because it was effectively swamped for the scales where the physical quantities were measured. So it was just a kind of ad hoc procedure to get rid of the ultraviolet divergences. Now, with the modern day use of renormalization group equations that began with Gell-Mann and Lowe and some others in the 1950s, there was a very different approach taken to this notion of scaling. So the effective scale, what Gell-Mann and Lowe showed in their 1954 paper, was that the effective scale could be arbitrarily defined And it could actually vary to define the theory at any other scale. So we had a kind of sliding scale here. So what they did was introduce the idea of a mathematical function of the coupling parameter, where that function would determine the different the differential change of the coupling constant with small changes in energy. And you could do that using the, that's what the renormalization group allowed you to do. So specifically in the case, there was a beta function that encoded the dependence of the coupling parameter on the energy scale that was defined by the relation, the beta G relation. So the main point was that as the scale varied, the theory made, again, a self-similar replica with a small change in G given by the RG equation. So the self-similarity then stemmed from the fact that psi G depended only on the parameters of the theory and not on the scale. So that's a huge, that's the big difference between the renormalization group scaling and the old-fashioned renormalization. The early versions of renormalization, the parameters were specified at the outcome. They weren't a result of the renormalization calculation, the iterations. The change in length scale was simply changed from the bare values, changed the values from the bare values appearing in the basic Hamiltonian to the renormalized values. So we just got a change from one to the other. But in the RG, what happens is the parameters are determined at the outcome or at the by the outcome of the renormalization calculation. So at the end of the process, at the end of the iterations, as it were. So in one case, you have it as a result of the implementation of iterations, and at the other, it's specified at the outcome. So you can see then that it's just in the renormalization group case, it really is a function of the parameters rather than the scale. Now, so then this was extended, the notion of the use of this use of the renormalization group was extended into condensed matter physics to derive properties of critical phenomena that exhibited divergence in correlation length and a general slowing down of the dynamics. So particularly in second order phase transitions, what the RG allowed one to do was understand and explain certain kinds of experimental data in terms of scaling and universality, where you have similar behavior at critical point of systems like magnets and fluids, systems with very different microstructures, but nevertheless behave exactly the same way and at critical points show the same kinds of divergences. We think of a phase transition then as exhibiting the effects of a singularity over the spatial extent of the entire system. And it occurs, the peculiarity of course, with the phase transitions is that they occur only in infinite systems, infinite particles, infinite volume, or strong interactions. And you have a variation over a large number of length scales, a vast range of length scales. So what the RG does then is enable you to investigate the changes of the physical system as it's viewed from different distance scales. So these phase changes involve what's called an order parameter that will distinguish two phases describing the degree of order below the critical point. So in ferromagnets, it's homogeneous magnetization. And the order parameter just is, you can really think of it as just the sort of symmetry breaking that's associated with the system when it undergoes a phase transition. Doreen? No.
Yeah.
I've gone back to the RG extended to critical phenomena.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So the properties then near the critical point are determined primarily for the correlation length. For for fluctuations in this order parameter. So the order parameter is what describes the symmetry breaking at the phase transition, and near a critical point, you get fluctuations in the order parameter. And the properties of the system near a critical point are determined primarily by the correlation length for these fluctuations. And so you can define a correlation function that measures how the value of the order parameter at one point is associated with its value at some other point. So the idea is that you've got very long-range correlations, and you have fluctuations in this order parameter where they're identified or correlated with each other at distant points. So two points, then, that are separated by a distance larger than the correlation length will have fluctuations that are relatively independent. So you've got a correlation length. If you've got points that are separated by some larger distance, then those fluctuations are not going to be correlated in any way. They're going to be independent of each other. What happens at critical point is the correlation length diverges. So the correlation length goes to infinity. And so what happens then is these very distant points become correlated, and the long wave fluctuations start to dominate. So the system, in long wave fluctuations dominating, what happens is the system completely loses memory of its microscopic structure, and these long-range macroscopic correlations start to emerge, and new behavior results. So it's as though the microphysics is lost. The memory of the microphysics is lost, and these long-wave correlations start to dominate, producing the kind of cooperative behavior that you see. So RG then provides scaling equations for these correlation functions that we use in statistical descriptions of the system. Okay, so as the system is approaching critical point, what the RG does is show you how to understand or how to relate the system at one length scale to another. So it links the physical behavior across these scales where the fluctuations on many different length scales can interact. So it allows you to actually compare the behavior across these very large distances. So the question then is, why is that kind of thing important? Why is it important to be able to do that? And what's the impact of that technique or that ability to get these correlations on mathematical or physical explanation? What's the explanatory value of that? So here now we come to how it is that you get out physical explanations from that technique that allows you to talk about the system and correlations at very large distances. So we've got two ways of thinking about how it is we get physical explanations out of the use of renormalization group. Two sort of basic kinds of methods are Fourier space or momentum space, RG, and that's usually used with quantum field theory, and what's sometimes called real space or pencil and paper methods, and that's usually with condensed matter physics. There are other varieties within those two groups, but these are mainly the two groups. So if you're using momentum space RG with quantum field theory, essentially, a change in the scale is going to change the scope of the degrees of freedom that you have in your calculation. So if you want to avoid large logarithms, you take mu to be an order of energy that's relevant to the process under investigation. Integrate out all of the high wave numbers from the continuous spin field, and so the problem gets broken down into a series of sub-problems that each involve only a few length scales. Each one has a characteristic length, each subproblem has a characteristic length scale, and you get rid of the degrees of freedom that you don't need. So when you reduce the degrees of freedom, what happens is that you get a sequence of Hamiltonians that are pictured as a kind of trajectory. So you get a for each particular sequence of subproblems, you get an effective Hamiltonian, and that group of Hamiltonians can be pictured as a kind of trajectory that spans the entire system, the space spanned by the system parameters. So you get something that looks like this. When you apply R to the original Hamiltonian, you get H prime, what you do is you just rescale the fields using R to maintain the invariance of H. So the real space, so that's basically the momentum space approach. The real space approach is very similar, except that it involves lattice interactions. So you get a lattice interaction of interacting, a lattice of interacting spins, and you get transformations from a site lattice with a particular Hamiltonian to a block lattice with a different Hamiltonian. So it's exactly analogous to breaking down the problem and you getting the working with the degrees of freedom that you want. In this case, though, you start with a lattice and you move from the site lattice to a block lattice, and each one of the lattices has its own Hamiltonian. And so each lattice then is considered as a new basic entity. And what you do is then just calculate the effective interactions between them, and you again construct a family of corresponding Hamiltonians. So you start from a lattice model of size A, sum over the degrees of freedom while maintaining their average on a lattice of size 2A. And that just then gives you the recipe for finding the Hamiltonian. So the transition from the Hamiltonian in the site lattice to the Hamiltonian in the block lattice is just a recipe for obtaining parameters from the site, parameters at the site from parameters in the block lattice. And so then you just repeat that process for a lattice of larger and larger blocks. So what happens is you start something like this. You start off with a lattice that looks like that, and by a process of iteration and coarse graining, you end up with something that looks like this. So it's analogous to getting rid of the degrees of freedom. So again, the procedure involves carrying out statistical averages over thermal fluctuations for a lot of different sizes, because you keep going from one to the other. You start off in sequence with the atomic level and then move to successively larger scales until the fluctuations on all scales have been averaged out. Now, the important point here is that close to the critical point, the correlation length, again, is going to far exceed the lattice constant. So the lattice constant being the space, where the space with the difference between neighboring spins. So you need, so for each block lattice, then you construct this effective interaction, and you find the connection between the block and the site. Or between the two effective interactions. And that's a procedure, this block spin approach that was introduced by Kadanoff in the 60s. Now, the extension of that approach was carried out by Wilson, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on renormalization group. And what he did was show how the coupling constant, so in the block spin approach, the problem is that you couldn't actually calculate the values for the coupling constants. What Wilson did was show how the coupling constants at different length scales could be computed, how the critical components could be estimated, and how to understand universality. That is, how to understand this idea that liquids and solids can behave, or fluids and magnets can behave exactly the same way at critical point. You can understand that from this process of iteration that's embedded in the renormalization group techniques. So how does that work? How do these kinds of, and why is it important to be able to do these sorts of calculate? Well, it's important, obviously, to be able to calculate the coupling constants. But how do you do that? How does that work? So the behavior of the thermodynamic parameters are characterized by these quantities called critical indices. And these universal, these systems that share the same universality class, for example, magnets and fluids, have the same critical indices. And so those systems that have the same critical indices are going to behave in exactly the same way at critical point, regardless of their microstructure. So the correlation length, then, of these particular kinds of systems, we get correlation length increasing. The correlation length is, the way in which you can think about properties being correlated, fluctuations of the order parameter being correlated. The correlation length increases as the system goes to critical point. And at critical point, it diverges. So the fluctuations in the order parameter at critical point become completely dominant, and we're left without any characteristic length because all the lengths are equally important if you've got divergence. So using the renormalization group to reduce the degrees of freedom amounts to establishing this kind of correlation between, or correspondence between, a particular problem with one correlation length and another one that's smaller. So as the process is iterated, then, the Hamiltonian becomes more and more insensitive, and I mentioned this earlier, to what happens on smaller length scales. And what happens is this process, then, this iteration, leads to a fixed point when the system is at a critical point. And it's the properties of this fixed point and that determine these critical exponents that, in turn, characterize the fluctuations at critical point. So the same fixed point interactions are able to describe a variety of different types of systems. Okay, so I sort of said that. So the basis of universality, then, the idea that you can have these two different sorts of systems behaving the same way, is that the fixed points become a property of the transformations that are not sensitive to the Hamiltonian, the original Hamiltonian of the system. So what does that mean? Well, you've got a Hamiltonian of a fluid, for example, versus one of a magnet. That incorporates very different kinds of information. But in the process of using the renormalization group, what happens is, as the system gets transformed, and as you go to longer and longer length scales, the initial information that was encoded in the original Hamiltonian becomes lost. As the long length scales, and especially as one gets to infinity, as the long wavelengths start to dominate, the microscopic behavior that was encoded in your original Hamiltonian is lost. The system loses memory of that. So what happens is, then, at critical point, you get Hamiltonians with information that that isn't sensitive to the original microstructure, and consequently, the two kinds of systems that share the same sorts of fixed points actually exhibit exactly the same sort of behavior. So the behavior then becomes, or the existence of the same fixed points becomes, a property of this iterative transformation. It's a property that results from the process of iteration rather than something that relates to the specific microstructure of the system. So that's why different kinds of phenomena can actually appear, or can actually have the same sorts of, belong to the same universality class, because their microstructure is irrelevant to their behavior at critical point. So what the fixed points do, then, and these systems excuse me, these systems have the same kinds of fixed points. And the fixed points are what determines the kind of cooperative behavior that's possible. So in other words, the fixed points determine the kind of ordering that takes place in the system. So it isn't just the elimination of degrees of freedom that's crucial with respect to the use of the renormalization group, but rather it's the existence or the production of this kind of cooperative behavior and its relation to the order parameter or the symmetry breaking that characterizes a different system. So you have this kind of cooperative behavior that manifests itself at large length scales, but we can see how that is the result of this process of successive iteration that starts from a Hamiltonian that incorporates the microscopic structure, but gradually iterates or gradually loses that information in the process of iteration. So how does the explanation work then? Well, we can see why the phenomena at critical point behave as they do, because they share these kinds of fixed points and share critical indices, rather. We can see also the relation between the order parameter and phase transitions, the symmetry breaking of the system and phase transitions, and why that behavior is insensitive to the original underlying microphysics. But I think most importantly, what the RG framework gives you is a physical understanding of the relation between the dynamics of the system and the assumptions about the thermodynamic limit. So how does it do that? Well, what it does is show us that the phase transitions are connected not just to the fluctuations in the order parameter as part of the microscopic features of the system, but also to the topology of the infinite spatial region and why this infinite spatial region is crucial for determining within the RG calculations why a transition has taken place. So in other words, the idea that the correlation length becomes larger and larger and then at critical point diverges, what that information is encoded in the idea of the thermodynamic limit. And it's only at that point where you get this kind of cooperative behavior fully being fully realized. So the thermodynamic limit then becomes not just a kind of calculational device, but it actually incorporates this kind of physical picture of the phenomena in the case where you've got correlation over very vast spatial regions. So I think that becomes especially crucial if you think about the relationship between something like renormalization group and mean field theory. One of the advantages of renormalization group over mean field theory was you could extend the list of possible couplings to all the different terms that could be found in the Hamiltonian. The mean field theory, although it could calculate a number of these sorts of quantities, really broke down in many ways at critical point because it didn't take account of fluctuations in the order parameter. So each transformation with the RG group increases the size of the length scale so that the transformation would eventually extend the information about parts of the system that are infinitely far away. So you get this spreading out. So the infinite spatial extension then becomes part of the calculation. And it was that behavior at far reaches that would determine the thermodynamic singularities and thereby including them in the calculation. So the phase transition was identified as the place where the transformations brought the coupling to a fixed point where further iterations of the renormalization group involve no changes to the couplings or to the correlation length. So the fixed point then is the point where you progress or successive applications make no change whatsoever to either the couplings or the correlation lengths. And the fixed point is the point where the phase transition is identified. So the key here is that the transformation multiplies the length scale by a factor that, again, depends on the details of the transformation and not on the microphysical quantities. And this is the really important thing, is the way in which the transformation properties determine the values of these critical indices. So from a kind of mathematical method, then, you get a sort of genuine physical understanding. So it's not just about taking a limit or taking a thermodynamic limit, although that's part of the explanation. But it really does, I think, involve going beyond that to explain how these dynamical features of the system and about how the dynamical features of universal behavior arise and why we need the thermodynamic limit, not just as a calculational device. So it encodes, so what the RG does then, I think, is encode the relation between the microscopic features of the system that are part of the order parameter and the macroscopic, the long-range correlations, in the sense that the iteration of the scaling operation represents how one moves from the very small to the thermodynamic limit, to the infinity. And so I think it also shows that it isn't simply an operation of taking limits. It's a special kind of limit that contains important physical behavior. So the physics and the mathematics then, I think, become intertwined. But the physical explanation really arises out of the mathematical framework because it arises out of this process of the iterative transformation. It doesn't come out of the microphysics. It doesn't come out of the information that's encoded in the original Hamiltonian. It comes out of what you get at the end after you've done the transformation has been done several times. So the idealization that's embedded in the thermodynamic limit, the notion of an infinite system, the notion of an infinite bulk volume, represents this behavior of the system where you have very long, where the system is now characterized by very long wavelength correlations, leaving out the microscopic. So it's not simply a calculational device that we need to reify in order to get the right answers. It actually embodies dynamical information. So the how question, the technical question of how we are able to compute critical indices and how we're able to apply the renormalization group to get certain kinds of quantitative results. And the why question, the conceptual question of how it is that we can understand the dynamics of these systems as they approach critical point or as they exhibit critical behavior, and why the thermodynamic limit is important from a sort of conceptual point of view, I think really merge into one here. And the notion of a thermodynamic limit, I think, really does embody a kind of representation of the system insofar as it takes account of this long-range correlation and this kind of ordering cooperative behavior that is produced at critical point where you have to take account of the infinities. Okay. I had a quick appendix, but let me just stop there. It's 12 o'clock, so I've talked enough. Okay.
Sure. Since you know everybody. Eric.
Well, first of all, thank you for the talk. This is very provocative, at least for me. I want to press you on this issue about thermodynamic limit.
Mm-hmm. That's the sticking point, everybody, that I think for philosophers, everybody sort of thinks that's a really illegitimate.
Well, it's not illegitimate, I just...
Well, illegitimate in the sense of, you know, it's not really a physical thing, so what's going on with it?
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have a bucket of water, it's put across, I lower the temperature, it freezes. Now, if I want to represent that phase transition using group renormalization group methods, I claim that by the time I've iterated out the length scale to 6 million light years, the renormalization group is just irrelevant. The thermodynamic limit is just irrelevant. All that matters really are the rescalings up to about a foot, because the system is only a foot across. Now, what's important is that a foot is much, 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 much bigger than the scale of intermolecular forces in the water. That's all that really matters. Because if I take the scale of 6 million light years when I'm trying to model my 1 foot across bucket, I'm going to completely miss all the surface term, all the surface behavior, the behavior of the water as it freezes on the surface. That's exactly what you're doing at thermodynamic limit. You're just saying, I don't care about surface behavior. But if you actually want to model the system in some sense more thoroughly, you have to take account of surface behavior, and the renormalization group explicitly doesn't allow you to do that. So in one sense, I just don't see how it's anything but a calculational device, given that when you apply it to a real system, you know, going out 6 million light years is utterly irrelevant to the system, even though formally that's part of the renormalization group method.
Well, there's a couple of different answers to that. And one is that it depends on what exactly you think you're explaining with your bucket of water. And if you really think that you're explaining or that you're sort of telling us about phase transitions, then really you're not. Because really, phase transitions don't occur in finite systems.
That's exactly right.
So the question then becomes, what is it that you're explaining? And
I'm explaining the behavior of the physical system.
Okay, but you're not explaining phase transitions.
All the words for phase transitions, they don't really occur.
But they do occur.
can you show me a real physical system in which a phase transition of the sort that the renormalization group reports to model actually occurs?
Well, I think the thing is that what we need to talk about, or what I think what the important difference here is, whether we want to talk about, from a theoretical point of view, general properties of a system that renders it understandable from the point of view of what we call phase transitions. Or do we want to talk about specific concepts? So, you know, you use something like the one-dimensional Ising model. Okay, that's a pretty good model for a ferromagnet. But, you know, it leaves out all sorts of things. You know, it doesn't have very much content in it.
Absolutely.
Right? So then you say, well, okay, look, well what good is it? Well, it's a hell of a lot of good if you think that what you're trying to do is explain phase transitions. But then the question becomes, well, okay, do phase transitions actually exist? And if phase transitions only exist in physical systems, then what's going on?
You mean in theoretical systems?
In theoretical systems, yeah. Then what's going on? And I think that's a sort of legitimate philosophical question. I mean, because we take it to be the case that phase transitions do occur in the world.
I take it that we think that the idea of a phase transition is an excellent approximation to what happens in the world.
So
just like setting friction equal to zero in plain Newtonian mechanics. It's an excellent approximation, even though we don't really think there's any system that has zero friction, any macroscopic physical system.
Right, okay. So then I don't think we disagree.
I'll think about that.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask a question, not so much on the details of what you were saying about the renormalization group, interesting though those were, but the sort of points you started with and the kind of underlying assumption. You know, you can go that quote from Wigner about the unreasonable process of mathematics. And I got the impression that you're kind of tacitly making a sharp distinction between the kind of predominantly, though not entirely, verbal reasoning you get in biology and the more mathematical reasoning that you get in physics. And sort of there's a sort of assumption these are really dramatically different things. And I'm wondering if they are. Russell and Frege famously set out to reduce mathematics to logic, and that seemed attractive because they were kind of going to grow mathematics out of something that is really a feature of ordinary language. Logic is abstracted from ordinary language. And I think Wittgenstein commented on this, that what Russell had really done wasn't to reduce mathematics to logic, but rather to turn logic into a branch of mathematics, which I think there's a lot of truth in. If you look at mathematical logic, it's a structure that's a formalization of what we do in ordinary language, the kind of thinking biologists use, but I mean, it really is a branch of mathematics. I don't know how you define a branch of mathematics, but it seems about as mathematical as anything. So I'm wondering if there really is such a sharp distinction, or indeed if there's really a fundamental distinction at all. And maybe what Wigner should really have talked about is the unreasonable effectiveness of thinking. When you ask about whether you can get some physical explanation of mathematics, it's like asking if you get a physical explanation by thinking. I mean,
yeah. No, I agree with you. I didn't intend to imply that there was a sharp distinction, I suppose. In fact, I think that my conclusion kind of speaks against it. So the sharp distinction, I think, was probably I was sort of describing the way that the debate typically gets characterized. A lot of the discussion in the philosophy of mathematics is about this distinction between a mathematical explanation versus a physical explanation. And so then when the mathematics seems to provide or seems to have a necessary place in the physical explanation, then does that give us some kind of reason to be mathematical realists? And so what I was trying to say was that, that debate, interesting as it is for philosophers of mathematics, I think there's a different way that as philosophers of science or philosophers of physics, one might want to approach that. And that's from the point of view of how it is that physics and mathematics seem to come together in certain kinds of situations where it looks like the mathematics is generating a physical explanation, or indeed, as many people say with group theory, that it sort of generates a physical dynamics. And like the quote from Weinberg where he says, from the symmetries dictate the existence of forces. Well, God, how does that work, right? What I was trying to point out was that I think that, in fact, in many of those kinds of examples, what you get is a kind of integrated explanation where it becomes very difficult to separate out the physics and the mathematics.
I wanted to ask you about a bit of a slide in what's being explained here, the explanandum.
Uh-huh,
and it's
sure.
One that Bob Adaman makes as well, and I'm not happy when he makes it, so I'm wondering if you are following him or if you have some better idea here. I mean, you say the renormalization group enables you to explain the experimental data. And that would be the phase transitions, the critical parameter beta in each individual case. And then you say, but it also enables us to explain the feature of universality, which is the fact that all these different systems,
mm-hmm.
which are realized in these different ways,
mm-hmm.
have the same or very similar critical
mm-hmm.
response.
Mm-hmm.
So, philosophers can disagree on whether the renormalization group really figures in the explanation of the individual phenomenon.
Right.
And I can see that as a behavior phenomenon. But the explanandum of universality is different. Something that I worry about. You're explaining there not that any that this system and that system and the other system have these features, but the commonality of the features.
Right.
So what Bob seems to be saying, and I think you're saying the same thing, is that somehow the explanation of that regularity is different than just explaining the behavior in each individual case.
Right.
Somehow
yeah.
the normalization group gives you an explanation of the regularity that doesn't kind of reduce to the explanations of the individuals.
Right, and in fact it can't reduce to the explanations of the individuals. I mean, I completely agree with what he says on that
mm-hmm.
point. In fact, it couldn't, because if it did, then, I mean, the whole point of the universality claim is that we've got something that is common to all of these systems, that are very systems which are very, very different. So how is it possible to explain why liquids behave exactly the same way at critical point that magnets do? So that has to be something that is a generality or a general claim about the nature of those two systems at critical point, because that's where the behavior becomes apparent. And it has to be something about the systems that is independent of their microstructure, because their microstructure is so different that the difference, those differences can't be part of the explanation.
Can I respond?
Yeah, of course.
It just seems to me kind of similar to, you have a system that exhibits, you know, periodic behavior, like a simple pendulum made of metal, you've got another one made of wood. And it's kind of, it seems to me a bit like you're saying, well, you can explain the similarity of the behavior based on, you know, the pendulum law, not based on the actual constitution of dynamics of the system. Mm-hmm. So to put the point maybe a bit different, maybe get back to Eric's question. So for the calendar kind of a lot of folks who think, no, there's some, this is a calculational scheme, there's some other actual explanatory derivation of this behavior. Bob responds, well, sure, you could, that might be true, but you haven't explained universality. You just explained the behavior in each individual system, and something's missing. So my worry is, well, no, nothing's really missing. Once you've explained the behavior in each system, assuming you can do it, that's all there is to it. There's no phenomenon or experimental data that constitutes universality. That's the worry.
Well, I guess the depends on what you mean by phenomena, right? Because what I would say is, well, there is a phenomena. There are phenomena that constitute universality, and it's this sharing of critical indices. These systems all have the same critical indices, and they all flow to the same fixed points. So that's the phenomena. That's that. Okay, so you'd say, okay, well, look, that's what we mean. We mean by universality a couple of different things. We mean they all behave in the same way at critical point. Okay, so there's that. They diverge in exactly the same way. So what does that mean? Well, that means then, so how do we account for that from within the sort of technical apparatus? And we say, well, they all share the same critical indices. Okay, so they all share the same critical indices. They all flow to the same fixed points. So that's the kind of technical version of what universality means. So then you say, okay, so how is it then that we can explain that phenomenon about this sharing of critical indices? So we then explain that phenomena by employing or by appealing to the renormalization group, which shows us that if you take every case, each individual case, you start from the Hamiltonian that incorporates the microscopic nature of the system. So it incorporates the microstructure. And you start doing successive iterations. You'll find that when each of those systems gets to critical point, you get divergences or blow-ups that are exactly the same. You get critical indices that turn out to be exactly the same. And so what that shows is that it doesn't matter what that microstructure actually is or what that Hamiltonian actually encodes. Because by the time you get to the critical behavior, where you've got huge length scales, you've got, you know, all the length scales that are equally important, all that microstructure is lost. So that's then, and it's that kind of, so that's why the critical indices, the values become the result of the transformations and application of the transformations. It's got nothing to do with the micro nature of the system. So that's the sense in which the renormalization group explains it, because it shows how the value of the indices are the result of this iterative process. I don't know if that
convinces you. We can chat later.
Yeah, okay.
So I want to press you on the point about whether renormalization groups should be thought, methods should be thought of as calculational methods, or whether you have some more robust physical explanation that they're giving you. So I think that one of the interesting things about renormalization group methods is, as you started to get into, that they're applied in the context in which philosophers have mostly so far been familiar with them in the condensed matter cases and in statistical mechanics, but they're also applied, I think, really to quite different ends in quantum field theory and in particle physics. So one way of thinking of renormalization group methods as a sort of calculational method or calculational technique would be to say, okay, well, they're sort of like more sophisticated versions of perturbation series, right? I don't mean in any sort of technical mathematical sense, but so perturbation series, you can apply that kind of calculational technique in a whole range of physical cases, right? Are we really learning anything much about physics when we do that? Well, I mean, sure, you have to make certain assumptions about the perturbation being small relative to whatever scale you're considering, and there are some physical assumptions that go in to the background for so you can use a method, but we don't really think we're learning anything very substantial about the physics when we apply perturbation series. So then I guess the question is, renormalization group methods, can you think of them as being a sort of similar technique where they're really useful when you have to take into account fluctuations on all sorts of different length scales, right? So when you have to do calculations that have that feature, then it's actually really mathematically really hard. So these mathematical methods are really useful if you need to get a calculational handle on those types of situations. So what do you think about that kind of?
Well, I think it's true that they are really helpful, and they certainly are in some ways like perturbation techniques. But I guess what I want to say is that you can actually tell a story about them. Let me go back from this. I think there's an interesting story to be told about the relationship between renormalization group methods in condensed matter and renormalization group methods in quantum field theory. And, you know, what's going on. In one case, you're using, you're interested in systems, very low energy systems, and in other cases, you're interested in very high energy systems. In one case, in both cases, you're getting rid of degrees of freedom, but are you actually doing the same sorts of things? So I think there's a kind of long and interesting story, maybe not so long, but certainly interesting story to be told there. Yeah, it probably is. but then to sort of answer your question, I think the thing that makes these, especially in condensed matter, that makes this a more physical story than just a story about calculational, than a method for calculational techniques, is that you really do understand why it is that systems belong to the same universality class. And it's not just because you can calculate the critical exponents. I think that in this case, that RG really does tell you, it tells you a story. In showing you how it is that these critical exponents are calculated, it's showing you how, as you move to longer and longer length scales, and as you see the cooperative behavior arising in these systems, it really shows you how it is that you can think of these systems as similar, because shows you why the microstructure is unimportant, and in showing you why the microstructure is unimportant, it becomes a more powerful explanation than just telling you, well, they have the same critical exponents and I can calculate those critical exponents, or I can provide you the I'll tell you how to compute the critical exponents. And it also, I think, embodies a story about why it is that the thermodynamic limit is so important. It's because you need to be able to represent the system as having these correlations over an infinite space. So it's not just, well, we have to assume infinite systems, and then once we assume infinite systems, then we can do these calculations. But it's, why do you need to do that? Why do you need to do that? Well, because the cooperative behavior only emerges. The true cooperative behavior only emerges in this infinite limit. And so you can see why the iteration of the transformation then gradually produces this kind of account. So I think it's true that they are calculational techniques, but I think if you dig a bit deeper and actually see how the transformations work, you can see how it is that the whole sort of physical story about how you get from the very small to the very big actually doesn't fall out, but you can extract it.
The way we're responding now brings back Andrew's question about the universality as opposed to the explanation of each. And so in the case of the bucket of water, once we get beyond certain scales, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But you're looking at this procedure for showing how, this formal procedure, I'm going to call it a formal procedure.
Yeah.
In the Hamel. Okay, that has certain features that wash out things at a certain critical point. Now you're doing something else with magnets or a different case. And now I want to explicitly put forward, never mind the story about for the individual cases. I mean, I'm getting carried away here. Even the individual cases, it would be nice to be able to say more about what it is about these actual systems and how they behave at different scales. I mean, as you're getting closer and closer, what are the actual features about these systems that make this limiting behavior that introduces this these infinities work the way they do? So what is it about the physical systems?
Do you want me to say?
Well,
I think it's just this notion of going to longer and longer length scales. I mean, and as you apply the transformation, as the length scales become larger and larger, so you're looking at a system as it's approaching critical point, right? As it approaches, as you're using the renormalization group transformations, as you're iterating the process, so the length scales are becoming larger and larger. You're getting rid of, you're coarse graining more and more. You're getting rid of more and more of the microphysics, until all of a sudden the correlation length starts getting larger and larger. And so you start getting cooperative behavior at long distances. You start seeing fluctuations of the order parameter, the symmetry of the system, starts getting correlated at longer and longer wavelengths, until you get to the critical point where you get divergence and all the lengths become equally important. So you need some way then getting rid of degrees of freedom at that point. And what the renormalization group does is enable you to do that. So it's the idea that you have a system that's approaching the critical point, and as it's approaching critical point, the correlation length is increasing and increasing and increasing, and the transformations mirror that, or the transformations represent that. That's what's going on. And then, at the thermodynamic limit, where you get the phase transition, you have the divergence. So you can tell a mathematical story a physical story that mirrors a mathematical story, or that corresponds to the mathematical story. In the case of one system, you can show why it is that the thermodynamic limit is important in describing the phase transition of that system and how you get from the microphysics to the larger one, to the larger wavelengths. And then you show, and then in the universality case, it's about showing why it is that, or explaining that all of these different systems that belong to the same universality class, in fact, behave in exactly the same way. And so it shows you how it is that occurs, because it allows you to calculate the critical exponents.
Now, one of the things that fell out in some, Bob wants to say that if I'm describing the particular system, I can't do the description, an adequate description of the particular system in terms of, that doesn't involve bringing in some way or other. Whereas Gordon wants to suggest that, in fact, you can do that. And that seems to be, where are you in that sort of...
I think this goes back to Eric's point, which is, what are you describing? Yeah. What are you trying to describe? And that was Eric's original question. Are you trying to describe, surface phenomena? What are you trying to explain here? And if what you're trying to explain is phase transitions, then that's what you need. You need the infinities. The phase transition, you can talk about the system being very, very close to critical point and its behavior as it approximates critical point. And that's where your mean field theory works fine there. As long as you're dealing with approximations and systems, finite systems that approximate critical point, you can start to see certain kinds of behaviors as systems approach critical point that differ very greatly from behavior further away. So yes, you can. You don't need renormalization group in that sense. You could perfectly well use mean field theory, but there's a whole lot of stuff then that you can't explain about phase transitions if you're going to stick to approximating critical point and approximating mean and using mean field theory. Then what you're explaining is something else. You're not explaining phase transitions. You're not explaining why the system where you get singularities. You're not explaining where you get the singularities from. So,
Eric gets the first crack over lunch, but let's thank Mark again.
I'll
and we'll have our